All right, so this is Bio 231, and it's March 30th. We're going to start peripheral nervous system today. So last time you had a test, I believe they're graded. You want to come by during office hours and take a look at your Scantron or something? That's fantastic. I wish you would do that. Your grades are on Blackboard. And let's see, what else do I need to say about that? I guess not too much. There was something else I wanted to say. Oh, there's still a few students that are marking up their Scantron, but I think I caught errors that the Scantron reader was making. Just don't put any stray marks, especially near the numbers of the questions on the edge of the Scantron, where all those tick marks are. That really messes up the machine. So, anyway. All right, so anybody have any questions over central nervous system? So far, so good? Okay. Moving on to peripheral nervous system. Well, make sure you know the definition of central nervous system and peripheral nervous system. And you could know this in a couple of different ways in terms of where they're located. Where is the central nervous system? Or what makes up the central nervous system? Brain and spinal cord. Yeah. And the peripheral nervous system is what? Everything else. Everything outside the brain and spinal cord. The other thing that you should know is that the peripheral nervous system has ways for you to communicate with your environment so that you can appreciate your environment. Part of the peripheral nervous system includes receptors. Yeah? Is it? The flow of CSF? Okay. I'll go back and do that. All right, I'll go back and do that. Maybe not right now, but after I kind of finish my thought. Okay, so peripheral nervous system includes receptors, and then it also includes nerves that take information from receptors, carries it to the central nervous system. The central nervous system then understands that information and makes a decision on what to do, and then it shares that information again with the peripheral nervous system. It takes that decision out to the periphery to any effector organ. So what we're going to look at this time around are the receptors, a little bit about receptors, and then how signals enter the central nervous system and how signals leave the central nervous system, but not actually what happens once those signals get into the central nervous system. So actually, we want to go back and take a look at flow, huh? Flow, cerebral spinal fluid. Ah, probably this one right here. Okay, so here we see a nice sagittal section of the brain. And cerebral spinal fluid fills the ventricles of the brain. The lateral ventricles are deep off of midline. They're lateral to midline, so we can't see the lateral ventricles right here. And then fluid flows through a little foramen, interventricular foramen, into the third ventricle, which is surrounding the thalamus. And then cerebral spinal fluid flows into the fourth ventricle, which is between the pons and the cerebellum right here. And then there's a little connection between them. And that's called the aqueduct of Sylvius, or the cerebral aqueduct. All right, so you might be wondering, well, why is there flow? Well, that's because cerebral spinal fluid is made by special kinds of neuroglia cells called ependymal cells when they're modified, when they have a large capillary associated with them. Cerebral spinal fluid you could think of as a modified plasma which makes up blood. It's a fluid that has proteins in it, and it has nutrients and electrolytes, but it shouldn't really have much in the way of blood cells. It shouldn't have red blood cells or white blood cells in it. And the areas that make cerebral spinal fluid are called the choroid plexus. And so there is a choroid plexus in the roof of the third ventricle right here. Maybe you can even see the color of it. I'm not really sure. Choroid plexus that produces that cerebral spinal fluid. And then it flows out of the brain, okay, through the cerebral aqueduct into the fourth ventricle. And there it could leave the fourth ventricle and enter the subarachnoid space by a couple foramina that are exit points. There are lateral apertures and a median aperture. So that's just another name for a foramen. And then it flows back up to the top of the brain. You can see the arrows flowing back up. And eventually, all right, so this is all the subarachnoid space, they leave through an arachnoid granulation or an arachnoid villus into the superior sagittal sinus. And a sinus is one of these things in anatomy that can contain a number of different things, like the paranasal sinuses. What do we have in our paranasal sinuses? There's air inside those, right, inside our nasal sinuses. These sinuses right here are acting like big, large veins that are draining blood from the brain back to the heart. So in this particular case, the superior sagittal sinus is going to have what kind of material in it? It's going to have, actually, blood, venous blood, that's draining back to the heart. All right, so again, you have to know the structure by what kind of material it takes. All right. The other thing that cerebral spinal fluid does is that it goes into the central canal of the spinal cord, and you see it can go all the way down to, what area is this right here where I have the cursor? That's the conus medullaris, that's the tip of the spinal cord, where it leaves into the subarachnoid space, and it can flow around the spinal cord, but eventually makes its way back up all through the subarachnoid space, and then it gets resorbed and put back into the circulatory system. So there definitely is a flow of CSF through the brain. And if any of these orifices get plugged, like the interventricular foramen between the lateral ventricles and the third ventricle, then of course it's going to fill up with CSF, it's going to compress the brain, and if it happens during development, then the skull of the neonate is going to be grossly distorted as well. It's going to just form this big balloon. And those things have to be reduced. All right, and hopefully before it reaches that condition that produces severe mental deficits as a result of that. And so sometimes we actually have to put a shunt in between a ventricle and maybe a vein someplace to drain the cerebral spinal fluid. Okay, so those are the ventricles, the lateral ventricles, the third, the fourth ventricle, the aqueduct sylvius, going through the midbrain and the central canal, and then fluid flows back up through the subarachnoid space and then gets resorbed, because basically it is like plasma. It gets resorbed, put back in the blood so that you don't dehydrate. You can't afford to lose that fluid. Okay, so this is probably a pretty good diagram to see. All right, what did I leave off your list? I don't have that list in front of me, but I think that's pretty much everything that should be on your list. So you should know what the origin of CSF is. What's the origin of CSF? The choroid plexus. Oh, you also have some in the fourth ventricle as well. Okay, there's a choroid plexus in the fourth ventricle. So there's a couple locations for choroid plexus. And if there is an infection of the brain, it shows up in the cerebral spinal fluid, and that's how that kind of infection is diagnosed. Some of that fluid is aspirated out, it's sucked out with a syringe, and then they look at it, they culture that fluid to see if anything is growing in there, and nothing should be growing in there at all. What's that called when somebody removes some CSF from your... Yeah, we call that a lumbar tap, or a spinal tap, because we don't get that fluid out from your brain. Since the fluid is continuous with the spinal cord, we always go below the level of the spinal cord, below L2, and it's easy to get not easy for the patient necessarily, but it's relatively easy for a physician to get that fluid out, yeah.
So when they do lumbar puncture,
there should not be blood when they take out the CSF? There should not be blood, that's right. Yeah, that would probably be an indication of an infection. Yeah. Okay, so that's it for the cerebral spinal fluid. Okay. All right, so let's continue on with the peripheral nervous system. And Oh, I have it right here. Yeah, that's good. We got them all. Okay, the peripheral nervous system is what? Everything outside the brain and spinal cord. And there are different ways that you should think of the peripheral nervous system. First, with some functional organization, there are sensory fibers and there are motor fibers. Right? And I think I showed you this right at the very beginning when we first started talking about neuroanatomy. And sensory fibers, which way are signals moving for sensory fibers? And then they have an alternative name as well. Yeah, afferent, they go from CNS, no, from periphery to central nervous system is sensory or afferent. And the second division would be the motor division, otherwise known as the efferent. And so that's how decisions leave your central nervous system, go to effector organs. So that's motor or efferent. And furthermore, we can break the motor division down into two divisions, just like the sensory division. It could be somatic versus visceral, or maybe you could use the term autonomic. Visceral and autonomic mean pretty much the same thing. Somatic means that it's going to organs that you have voluntary control over. And what is the only thing that you have voluntary control over in your body? Skeletal muscle, right? And so the autonomic nervous system goes to everything else. Goes to all glands, smooth muscle, and cardiac tissue, cardiac muscle. All right. Not only can we break the peripheral nervous system down into its functional categories, but also its structural categories. So first, let's start with receiving information. You have peripheral sensory receptors. Give me an example of a sensory receptor that you have in your periphery. On your skin. Your skin is your integument, but give me an example of a receptor. Okay, like somebody said pain. You have pain receptors in your skin, for instance. Okay, and those are free nerve endings. You also have, then on the other end, peripheral motor endings. What's on the end of an axon that is used to communicate with other cells? Yeah, the axon terminals, which are the beginning of the synapse, right, which is the structural and functional unit of communication between cells. And the axon terminus has what? It's a swelling that has synaptic vesicles that can release neurotransmitter, for instance. Okay. All right, and then the nerves. There are two kinds of nerves that leave the central nervous system. And what are the two main parts of the central nervous system again?
The brain and brain.
Yeah, brain and spinal cord. So guess what? We name some names from where they leave the central nervous system. So there are nerves that leave the brain, which is the cranium, so we call those cranial nerves. We don't call them brainium nerves, we call them cranial nerves. And then there are other nerves that leave the spinal cord, and those, however, are easy to name because we call those spinal nerves. All right, so you have 12 pairs of cranial nerves and then 31 pairs of spinal nerves. And you're going to have to know some of these and maybe a lot of the cranial nerves. Okay, but don't forget where they come from. All right, so that's just an overview of peripheral nervous system. All right, so peripheral sensory receptors are structures that pick up information, some kind of energy in our environment, and then send that information to the central nervous system via an afferent pathway. They can be free nerve endings, right, like pain and temperature, or they can be receptor cells. And receptor cells are a little bit more specialized. So one of those two general kinds of categories. All right, we can classify receptors by their location. For instance, exteroreceptors are what you have located that directly sense something in the outside environment. So you have those on your skin, for instance. And good examples of those would be touch and vibration, pain, pressure, temperature, okay, and then most special organs are on the outside of your body, like your eyes, right, and your nose for picking up odorant molecules. And then we have interoceptors. Interoceptors are inside your body that are could be measuring things that are happening inside your body. And for instance, maybe you're having a heart attack and you can measure pain. Well, pain that you have deep inside your body is a whole different kind of presentation compared to pain receptors that you have on the surface. Surface pain receptors give you a very acute sense of pain, but visceral pain receptors are very dull and aching, a whole different kind of appreciation, but nonetheless, they're not any less intense, they just have a different form to them. Okay, so you can't ignore visceral pain either. Nausea, hunger, the sense of fullness, these are all produced by interoceptors that you have inside your body. All right, so they're really sensitive to more kinds of chemicals and stretching, as well as temperature. So the temperature receptor that regulates your body temperature is in your hypothalamus. But when that temperature receptor is monitoring your body temperature, you don't have a sense of hot or cold like you do for temperature receptors that are exteroreceptors, right? Those receptors just share information with what? Sweat glands, for instance, and muscles, things that might cool you down or cause muscles to contract to help warm you up. And then the third kind of receptor are what we call proprioceptors. Proprioceptors give you a sense of body position. They're involved with your musculoskeletal system. And these are found in all muscles, in tendons, and in joint capsules as well. So they measure tension in all of these different positions of your body or different organs of your body so that your cerebellum knows exactly what position your body is in and if it's a helpful or harmful position to be in. Okay, we can also classify receptors by the kind of stimulus that's required for them to operate. So for instance, there are mechanoreceptors that can monitor mechanical events. So for instance, if somebody pokes you in the side, that's a mechanical event, that's not light hitting you. All right, so pressure and vibration are mechanoreceptors. Thermoreceptors can monitor temperature, so we call them thermoreceptors. There are chemoreceptors that can measure chemicals, like maybe what kinds of chemicals do you think it would be important for you to be able to monitor? Hormones, yeah. Yeah, neurotransmitters, for instance, yeah, receptors. What about acid? Is the acidity of your body a very important consideration? Yeah, we call that pH. So there are pH receptors deep inside our body that keep close watch on our pH all the time. Yeah. Those are chemoreceptors as well. Yeah, because they're responding to chemicals that you put on your tongue and you have chemoreceptors in your nose. Okay, that's a whole chapter. We're going to spend a whole chapter looking at some of those things when we're done with this one. Okay, and then photoreceptors. Where do you have photoreceptors? Photo refers to light. And the only place where you really have photoreceptors are your eyes. You have photoreceptors in your eyes. Okay. And then nociceptors are receptors specifically for monitoring what we call noxious stimuli, like some kind of painful stimulus. And these could be deep inside your body or on your surface as well. It monitors pain, right? Or tissue damage is really a good way to say it. Tissue damage, irrespective of how that tissue damage is caused. It could be caused by excess temperature or excess acid, or it could be due to mechanical disruption of tissue as well. So tissue damage is a good way to say that. Okay, we can also classify receptors by their structure. All right, so some are encapsulated, some are non-encapsulated. Encapsulated ones would be like a Meissner's corpuscle, a Pacinian corpuscle, and a Ruffini's corpuscle. So let's see if we have pictures of these things. Yeah, so here's a picture of the integument, and here you can see a Pacinian corpuscle, and you can see how deep they are in the integument. They're down in the lower levels of the dermis. What layer is that anyway? That's the dermis. What layer of the dermis is that? The top one is the papillary layer, and the deep one is the reticular layer. So the Pacinian corpuscles are down in that reticular layer, so they're sensitive for deep pressure. Non-encapsulated would be like the ones around this hair follicle right here that send signals to the brain when the hair moves on the surface of the skin. Okay, some that are closer, like the Meissner's corpuscle, this is for light touch, you can see how superficial it is, as well as these Merkel's discs. right at the junction between the epidermis and the dermis. That's for very light pressure. And then you have free nerve endings right here for temperature as well as pain, and you have different kinds of receptors in free nerve endings. There's some that respond to cold, and then there are some that respond pretty much just to hot. So you have cold and hot receptors, both. And then the third class right here are proprioceptors, and these are the ones that give you a sense of body position. And you have basically three kinds of proprioceptors. You have those that are in muscle, that measure muscle tension. And the part of your, does anybody know what part of the brain always knows what the proper level of all your proper tension of all the muscles of your body should be? There's a part of the brain that's keeping track of all your muscles all the time and understands when you're performing a certain kind of motion what kind of proper tension should be in all the muscles of your body, postural muscles as well as those that are contracting. What part? Cerebellum. Somebody said cerebellum. That's right. So the cerebellum knows what the proper tension of all your muscles should be, and it's this muscle spindle right here that relays to the cerebellum what the actual tension is. And if there's an error, the cerebellum then makes an adjustment and causes that muscle to contract to bring you back into balance. So that's a pretty important job of the cerebellum. So you don't really have to think about moving anymore. Or, you know, unless you want to be really careful. Okay. So these are muscle spindles are in muscles. There are similar kinds of structures in tendons as well that monitor tension in tendons. It's kind of a backup system to the muscle spindles. And we call those Golgi tendon organs. So they measure stretch or tension on a tendon, and it shares that information with the cerebellum because the cerebellum knows what the tension of all these tendons should be. And then the third kind are what we call joint kinesthetic receptors in joint capsules. And remember, that's just what connective tissue that forms the joint around the joint. And so these sometimes are like Pacinian corpuscles. Sometimes they're like Ruffini's corpuscles. Sometimes they're free nerve endings. And sometimes they're even specialized, what we call Golgi tendon organs. Again, that monitor overstretching of joints so that you don't damage joints. These are all providing the sense of proprioception. So where do you have the sense of proprioception? Like in one or two parts of your body or where? Everywhere, yeah. All muscles, all tendons, all joints have these proprioceptors. I'm going to make a big point of that when we get to the senses chapter. Okay. All right, so let's talk about innervation of the different kinds of effector organs. So let's break effector organs down into two categories again. What are the two kinds of effector organs? If you were going to break it down into two parts, how could you think of doing that? Okay, so they're all going to be motor. Effector organs means that they're receiving motor signals from the central nervous system. And can anybody figure out a way to break down effector organs into two main classes? Okay, so one you have voluntary control over. Those are somatic. Okay, or what's another name for somatic? Somatic is voluntary. Voluntary. And so the other one is autonomic or involuntary. Those you don't have voluntary control of, those effector organs that are taken care of by your central nervous system automatically. Okay, so there are two different kinds of systems. So innervation, somatic innervation only goes to skeletal muscle. Autonomic innervation goes to visceral muscle and to all glands. So for instance, what would be a visceral muscle? Visceral means not on the surface of your body, not part of your musculoskeletal system, but muscle that's deeper. That would be smooth muscle and cardiac muscle, right? Okay. So innervation of skeletal muscle we looked at, we saw that was the neuromuscular junction, that was the synapse, and that kind of synapse is a nice chemical synapse. The neurotransmitter that's used is acetylcholine, so there are receptors on skeletal muscle that can bind acetylcholine, which then causes depolarization of that skeletal muscle. What does depolarization mean to you? That means that there is a channel that opens, and it allows what, an ion to enter that cell, the muscle cell. What ion is that? It would be a sodium. When sodium enters a cell, that causes depolarization, that changes the electrical property of that cell, because sodium is, it's a charged particle. It's an electrically charged particle. So indeed, it does manipulate electricity of these cells. Acetylcholine, the neurotransmitter, is broken down by acetylcholine esterase, so that once you send a signal to a skeletal muscle to contract, it doesn't stay contracted, what, your whole life. Eventually, what, it relaxes so that you can cause it to contract again, right? So you have control, contraction and relaxation control over that skeletal muscle. If there was no acetylcholine esterase, once you contracted a muscle, then that pretty much would be it for a long period of time. It would just stay contracted. So you could inhale, but you couldn't exhale until you're already passed out. So that wouldn't work, right? So that's the job of acetylcholine esterase. All right, and neurons which secrete acetylcholine and have acetylcholine receptors are called cholinergic. All right, so those neurons are called cholinergic neurons. Those are cholinergic receptors. Acetylcholine.
Is that like with rigor mortis?
Rigor mortis is caused by when you run out of ATP. Then the myosin cross bridge won't release from actin and it forms this latched state. So muscle stays in a contracted form when you run out of ATP. That's rigor mortis. Okay. Okay, so not quite acetylcholine. And I think we talked about a motor unit already. Motor unit is a single motor neuron, and it will diverge, it will bifurcate and innervate a number of skeletal muscles. So when there is electrical activity on that one motor neuron, then a number of muscle fibers within a muscle will contract, not the whole muscle itself, right? So for instance, when I'm contracting my biceps right now, does that require a strong contraction or a weak contraction? I would say weak, because I don't have anything in my hand to lift up. Right, so only a very few motor or very few muscle fibers within that muscle are contracting. Right, but if all of a sudden I put a 100-pound sack of potatoes in my right hand and do a curl with that, how many muscles am I going to be using, muscle fibers? How many muscle fibers will I be using in my biceps then? Probably pretty much all of them. Right, the rest will be recruited to contract to generate more tension to lift a heavier weight. So motor units are recruited as the demand on that muscle is increased to develop more tension. All right, the other thing about a motor unit is, which type of motor unit has more precise control? One that has few muscle fibers per motor unit or many muscle fibers per motor unit? And where, give me an example of what part of the body might have one of these kinds of motor units. So what kind of motor units would you want, say, for your fingertips? What kind of motion do you have on your fingertips? Okay, you have fine discrimination, right? A lot of dexterity. So you have motor units with very few muscle fibers connected to a motor neuron, so that there's a large degree of gradation between contractions with your fingers. All right, but what about muscles in your back? Do you do any kind of artwork, speech with back muscles? What do you do with your back muscles? Okay. Basically, you just contract back muscles to stand up straight, and that's pretty much about it. So the motor units are very large in your back, because you're not trying to do any kind of fine motor activity with postural muscles like you might with other parts of your body, like facial muscles and muscles around your hand, and muscles for articulation. Okay, your lips and your pharynx, for instance, have very small motor units. Okay, innervation of visceral muscle and glands is quite a bit different. So maybe I'll show you a couple pictures of these things. All right, so this right here just represents a proprioceptor that we have in a muscle. What do we call proprioceptors that we have in a muscle called? Those are muscle spindles. Those are muscle spindles. All right, and here is a junction between an axon terminus, right, and a muscle. And this is a neuromuscular junction, okay? And you can see vesicles with neurotransmitter right here. When an action potential comes down this axon terminus, it causes the fusion of this vesicle to the presynaptic membrane. The neurotransmitter is released into the synaptic cleft right here. And what's the name of this neurotransmitter? That's acetylcholine. And then it binds to a receptor on the muscle cell, which then causes another electrical signal on this muscle cell, okay, which causes the muscle to contract. Okay, here is a picture of a motor unit. Here is a motor neuron. And this one right here I can see bifurcating just once. So when there's an electrical signal on motor neuron number one, only this muscle fiber contracts, and this one over here. If motor neuron number two has an electrical signal, how many muscle fibers are stimulated?
Three.
One, two, three. So in this case, motor unit number two is going to produce what, a 50% greater force of contraction because it has 50% more nerve fibers that are being innervated when that muscle, when that motor neuron has electrical activity in it. Okay. And so, don't forget, this is a typical kind of view of what the somatic synapse looks like, the neuromuscular junction where there's a swelling at the end of the axon right here that contains neurotransmitter, and that's it. But for autonomic nerves, right, the swellings are located all along the axon near the effector organ. So this is going to be, for instance, where in glands and cardiac muscle and smooth muscle. And all of these swellings right here have synaptic vesicles which contain neurotransmitter. And then that neurotransmitter will be released and somehow help control these smooth muscle cells. So these are what we call varicosities. There's no axon terminus for nerves innervating visceral organs and glands. They have varicosities filled with neurotransmitter. And what we're going to see in the next chapter is that we usually have two nervous systems going to a autonomic effector. How many nerves go to a skeletal muscle? Just this one motor neuron, right, which is always going to be excitatory. So when the central nervous system sends a signal to a skeletal muscle, that skeletal muscle always contracts, can never make up its mind whether it's going to contract or not. Right, for instance, if you're thirsty and you want to pick up your water bottle to get something to drink, and you give commands to those skeletal muscles to take a sip of water, do those skeletal muscles ever tell you, no, I don't want to do that? No. They automatically just follow your commands. That's why those are voluntary. But for smooth muscle and cardiac muscle, there are two nerves that go to most of these organs, and we're in the autonomic nervous system, we're going to see what the two divisions of those different nerves are. And the effector organ, like the smooth muscle, is going to listen to both signals and then make up its mind what it's going to do. If it's going to contract or not contract, or in case of the heart, it's going to speed up or maybe it's going to slow down, depending on what the balance of activity in those two different nervous systems are. All right, so the nervous system that goes to skeletal muscle is what the somatic motor is, the somatic nervous system. What goes to smooth muscle and glands again? The autonomic nervous system. All right, and I just told you there are two main divisions of the autonomic nervous system. Haven't talked about it yet, except on the very first day of the nervous system. Can anybody remember what the two divisions of the autonomic nervous system are? They're called parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system, and they have these varicosities. And so effector organs have to listen to both parasympathetic stimulation and sympathetic stimulation to develop their proper kind of activity. Okay, here's a sign-in sheet. So pass that around and don't forget the sign-in sheet. All right, so these are varicosities. All right, and these most varicosities don't release acetylcholine. There's a different kind of neurotransmitter, and that neurotransmitter is called norepinephrine. Another name, another more common name for norepinephrine is called noradrenaline. And there's one organ that secretes not norepinephrine, but epinephrine. Guess what the common name for epinephrine is? That is adrenaline. All right, and you've probably heard of adrenaline. What does adrenaline do to your system? Anything? Huh? Yeah, like what? Boosts what? Speeds up your heart rate, speeds up your respiratory rate, dilates your pupils, makes you sweat maybe. Okay, so a number of different kinds of effects. Okay, these nerves that release norepinephrine are what we call adrenergic nerves. Nerves that release acetylcholine are called cholinergic. So you either got cholinergic or adrenergic, depending on what neurotransmitter is used. So an adrenergic would be releasing norepinephrine, cholinergic would be releasing acetylcholine. So that's one way your body can figure out when to do something different, because different neurotransmitters are used in different parts of your body. And what's a neurotransmitter again? What does a neurotransmitter do for us? Yeah, it's a chemical signal that travels between cells to carry information, right? It can cause excitation, for instance, or it can cause inhibition, but it carries information to a neighboring cell. So information, for instance, let's go back to this picture. All right, so information is carried through this neuron right here is what kind of signal? This is a motor neuron, so a motor neuron means what? Signals are leaving the central nervous system. It's carried as an electrical signal, right? There is an action potential, sodium entering the cell, potassium leaving the cell. You got depolarization followed by repolarization. So there is an electrical signal that moves down the neuron, but that electrical signal can't hop from the neuron into the muscle. It's got to be converted into a chemical signal, and then once it's converted into that chemical signal, that chemical has to bind to a receptor on the muscle membrane, which then causes another electrical signal, and that electrical signal flows over the whole muscle. So the way the system works is that within a neuron it is an electrical signal. Through the synapse it's a chemical signal, and when it gets to the effector organ or the distal neuron, it turns into another electrical signal again. So signals are transmitted electrically, chemically, and then electrically through a chemical kind of synapse. Okay. All right, so let's talk about how nerves can leave the central nervous system. And let's start. And what are the two ways information can leave the central nervous system, the two kinds of nerves? Nerves that are around your brain, those are called cranial nerves, or nerves that leave your spinal cord, those are called spinal nerves. And some have numbers and some have names. Let's start with cranial nerves first. Okay, they're categorized by one of four different kinds of activity. Some are completely sensory. Which way do sensory signals go? They go to the brain from where? From receptors. Yeah, from receptors. Like your eyes have receptors for what? For vision. They have photoreceptors that can pick up light, and then that information is converted into action potentials that enter your central nervous system. And where do you have your eyes on your body compared to a lot of different kinds of senses? Are they way superior? Are they inferior? Are they posterior or anterior? How would you talk about them? They're very superior and anterior, right? And there's actually only one other organ that's more anterior than your eyes and almost as superior. You didn't mean to do that, right? Kind of push. Your nose, okay? Yeah, your nose is even more anterior than your eyes are. Okay, and so those would be sensory, right? So for vision, okay, for smell, those are all sensory neurons. And guess what? In those nerves, there are no signals that are leaving, right? So the optic nerve only has information that's taking sensory information to your brain. Some are only motor, completely motor, like for muscles of the head and neck, right? So you can see cranial nerves number 3, 4, 6, 11 and 12 are motor. Some are parasympathetic, That means that they carry involuntary information to parts of your body that you don't have control over, like glands, smooth muscle, and cardiac muscle. And then the fourth kind is that they have mixed activity. They can be both motor and sensory at the same time. Not a single nerve fiber, because remember, a single neuron or nerve fiber can only carry information one way. Which way is it that a neuron can carry information? Yeah, it's one way. How, and what is that one way? From dendrite, cell body, and then down the axon, right? So if there is a nerve that's mixed, then there have to be both kinds of neurons. There have to be sensory neurons as well as motor neurons, and right, they don't share information. Information just passes through them. All right, so those cranial nerves, 5, 7, 9, and 10 are mixed. Right, and you can see cranial nerve number 10, that's real important. It's on the mixed motor list, but it's also on the parasympathetic nervous system list here as well. If I was going to remember one thing, for sure I'd remember the cranial nerve number 10. How many cranial nerves are there? There are 12, right? And they're given numbers 1 through 12. But sometimes you also give them names by what kind of functions they produce as well. So cranial nerves have both numbers and a name. And sometimes when you have a big long list, like 12 names of something, you like to use a little trick to remember how things go, and that's called a mnemonic. All right, so a mnemonic is the use of a familiar phrase or saying or limerick or something that sort of is easy to remember, and then you know how to translate the information from the mnemonic into, say, a list of anatomical definitions. All right, and mnemonics are used a lot in anatomy and other kinds of disciplines, maybe even chemistry and even music, for instance. All right, so a mnemonic, here's a good web resource for mnemonics, and you can put different filters in the search for mnemonics, right? If you just want PG-13 mnemonics or whatever, or X-rated mnemonics or whatever, you can filter it just right. But of course, in class, don't ever bring any X-rated mnemonics from that site in here. All right, so a mnemonic that we can use to understand the cranial nerves is this one right here. It's on old Olympus's towering top, a fin in German view to hop. Now for me that's really easy to remember, because I don't know, I might be Finnish or something. I'm not really sure. But what's Olympus? Does anybody know what Olympus is? That's a mountain. That's a really famous mountain in Europe. It's a really, really tall mountain. Okay, so that's where that towering top means a mountain. So this is a Finnish person and a German person. They're looking down over a valley, and what do they see? They see fields of grain, namely hop, and what's hop used to make? Beer, for instance. Right, all right, so this actually makes perfect sense. All right, and so mnemonic just say that the first letter of every word corresponds to the first letter of a word you're trying to remember. So here are the cranial nerves. Olfactory is number one. Optic is number two, oculomotor is number three. And what is, okay, so what is the olfactory nerve?
Smell.
And where do you have the organ for smell? Most anterior part. So there you should maybe see a relationship between these cranial nerves and how they're arranged in your body. All right, they're arranged by the most anterior one compared to the most posterior one. So that's what we see on this slide right here. So knowing the numbers of cranial nerves is actually pretty easy to do. All right, so what's the most anterior one? That's got to be cranial nerve number one. And then cranial nerve number two. And number three. Number four. Okay, so that's easy. You can just count from anterior to posterior. So even if maybe you have to draw this diagram on the test, if I don't give you the diagram on the test, you could draw this and just say, oh, here are the cranial nerves. And then you can use that mnemonic to label in terms of the name designation besides the number. All right, so let's go back and take a look at some of these. Right, so it's actually pretty easy to see these cranial nerves. So olfactory is for smell, that's a sense of smell. Optic is for vision. Right, oculomotor controls your eyeballs, like Where your face is facing doesn't necessarily mean where you're looking, because you could be looking off to the side because you have some extrinsic eye muscles on your eyeballs that can move your eyeballs around inside your head. But this is also important because this nerve controls pupil constriction, right? It can give you pinpoint pupils when it's really, really bright outside. Okay, the trochlear nerve is for eye motion as well. The trigeminal is really important because that's sensory to the face, right, and even motor to the face. So that's part of the nerve that has to be anesthetized, for instance, when you go get dental work. Okay, there are different branches of the trigeminal nerve. Guess how many branches are there, major branches to the trigeminal nerve? Yeah, there are three, right? You know, in this class, we don't have to know all the branches and where they go, that kind of stuff. All right, abducens, that goes to one eye muscle, and you could probably tell me what the function of that nerve is. How does it move your eye? How would you guess? It abducts your eye, and when your eye abducts, let's just do one eye, which way does it go? Does it look to midline, or does it look laterally?
Lateral.
It looks laterally, okay, but you can't do that in both eyes, so the abducens doesn't send traffic, but... Don't try it because why? What did your mother say? Don't, because it could get stuck. That's probably not true, but it will hurt your face if you do it. I don't know. You have to give me a web resource for that. I don't know what that's called or what nerve is used for popping your eye. Usually that happens when you sneeze and you hold your breath. I'm just kidding. I was saying that in... I've never seen anybody pop their eyes out, but don't hold your breath when you have a sneeze either. But I'm not sure. I don't know anything about taking your eyeballs out. Well, some eyes are more prominent than others, okay, and that could be kind of a disease process, all right? If somebody has very prominent eyes that are sticking out of their head, if it's just one, okay, that might mean that there is a tumor behind the eye. All right, but if they're both, then that could be a result of thyroid disease. That's called exophthalmos. So it could be caused by tumor, it could be caused by a hormonal irregularity, a number of different kinds of things. And I'm not so sure about actually somebody taking their eyeballs out. I would leave mine right where they are. Okay, they're very, very prominent. That could be exophthalmos if it's bilateral, meaning what? Both at the same time. If it's just one, unilateral, then there's probably a tumor growing in there. And that might be producing vision deficits or something. Okay, or maybe not yet. But if only one eye, for sure I'd get a CT and find out what's going on with that. Right? Okay, abducens. All right, so you see abducens has got a what? It's got a right here in the mnemonic. Right? All right, the facial nerve has got what? Fin right here. Oh, no.
Yeah.
Fin. Oh, yeah. Fin. Oh, yeah. I got to get arranged a little bit better. Okay. And then vestibulocochlear, that's for hearing and balance. We're going to look at senses. The cochlea is the part of your inner ear that you use for hearing. Vestibular apparatus is part of the apparatus that's used for balance. We'll take a look at that in just a couple chapters. And what's in the mnemonic for that? And. So always use the first letter corresponding to the first letter of the cranial nerve, vestibulocochlear. Okay. Well, because before they simplified the name of the vestibular cochlear nerve, they used to call it the auditory nerve. Okay. But they simplified it and actually made it more sense because this nerve is not only important for hearing, but it's also important for balance, and that's what we call a vestibular sense, balance, right? When we get to senses, you'll see how that is. All right, so vagus, what you should remember is decreased heart rate, viewed, okay? A, again, accessory, that's going to be accessory to the vagus nerve, that's motor to the neck. Hypoglossal is motor to the tongue, but it's also for taste on the tongue, okay? So you might see that there are a lot of definitions or a lot of functions of these cranial nerves in your book, but if I was going to pick one, I will guarantee you it will be one of these that you have on your sheet right here, right? So I'm cutting things down for you to memorize, Right? You don't have to know all the muscles that these nerves innervate, all the different senses. Right? But you might want to know which ones are sensory, which ones are motor, and which ones are mixed. Okay, that means are what? Both sensory and motor, or both afferent and efferent. So guess what we have right here? Another mnemonic. All right? And probably you could use these mnemonics that I have, or you could make up your own, and then, of course, that would be what? Even you'd have an easier time remembering them yourself if you make them up yourself. Okay, I've actually heard some pretty cool mnemonics that students have used. So you can look at medicalmnemonics.com or make some up yourself. So the little mnemonic that's used to describe the 12 cranial nerves and whether they're sensory, motor, or mixed is what? Some say money matters, but my brother says big brains matter most. Okay? Or big bucks matter most. So you can make up anything you want. Okay? So if you remember these things, then you kind of know what? Cranial nerve number one. What's the function of cranial nerve number one? It's sensory. Cranial nerve number two is sensory. Cranial nerve number three, motor, right? Oculomotor. That's for moving your pupils and your eyeball around. So that's how you can use these mnemonics. So you don't just have to sit there and memorize this thing and practice it 1,000 times just to make sure you don't forget. Okay. All right, and so here are the cranial nerves. I'm sure this is an exam figure. You should probably know it for lab as well. All right, so that's cranial nerves. And then, what's the other way that nerves can leave the central nervous system? Through or via the spinal cord. So we call those spinal cords. Exactly right. And how many different spinal nerves are there? Oh, actually, how many pairs of spinal nerves are there? Right? There are 31. Just like cranial nerves, we said there are 12, but there are what? There's 12 pairs. I kind of misspoke. There's 12 pairs. Right, not just 12. Same thing for spinal nerves. And spinal nerves leave between the intervertebral foramina, right? Those holes in the spinal cord that you can't see unless you put a couple vertebrae together, right? And depending on what level they leave, they just have a number. Like C1 is leaving right above C1. The spinal nerve C2 leaves right above the C2. Etc., etc. Okay, so these don't have names, they just have numbers. And spinal nerves, there's nothing fancy about them like cranial nerves, they're all mixed. They both carry two-way traffic. All right, that's one way in the central nervous system, but two-way traffic in the peripheral nervous system. All right, so let me see, I guess maybe I'll zoom into this picture right here. Not bad. Okay, so here you can see a vertebral body right here, transverse process. Here's an intervertebral foramen. Here's the vertebral foramen with the spinal cord in it. And what part of the vertebrae can't you see that's sticking out the back? That would be the spinous process, right, of that vertebrae. All right, and so here you can see the white matter and the gray matter. And these are ways that nerves can either enter or leave the spinal cord. So this one right here is the posterior, which is called the dorsal root. So here is a root, this is a dorsal root, and then this one is going to be the anterior, yeah, or a proper name for that is ventral root, right? So ventral root and dorsal root. I told you how to remember these, I think, when we got to central nervous system. The ventral root is 100% what kind of traffic? Motor. And the dorsal root is 100% sensory, right? So there's not two-way traffic in these roots. These little branches coming out of the spinal cord, these are what we call rootlets, right? So they're going to be dorsal rootlets or ventral rootlets, one or the other, depending on where you see them. And then where the roots join together right here, that is the spinal nerve that is going to go to some part of your body. And the spinal nerve is made up of what? Sensory as well as motor fibers. So this nerve right here has what kind of function? Is it sensory or motor? It is what we call mixed, right? The spinal nerve is always mixed. And this swelling right here has got a group of nerve cell bodies of unipolar neurons. Unipolar neurons are sensory neurons. And so this right here is a group of nerve cell bodies in the peripheral nervous system. What do we call a group of nerve cell bodies in the peripheral nervous system? That's a ganglion. Yeah, that's a ganglion. So that's the dorsal root ganglion for all those sensory nerve fibers. Okay. So let's see, what did I leave out? Ah. Okay, a couple other things. Let me move over. Oop, too far. Let me move here. Not bad. All right. So here's the spinal nerve. All right, so this is mixed. And notice that we see a bifurcation. There's a nerve right here. This is what we call a ramus. So a root sends signals into a ramus. This is the anterior ramus, which is going to take signals to every place in your body that's anterior to your spinal cord. And this one right here is the posterior ramus. This is taking signals to every place in your body that is posterior to the vertebral column or spinal cord. So where do you have more of your body, anterior or posterior to the spinal cord?
Anterior.
So guess what size that nerve has to be? It's got to be bigger and larger than the posterior ramus. So here's the anterior ramus, here is the posterior ramus. And you can see it splitting off of what? The spinal nerve. So the spinal nerve is mixed. So don't get the function of the ramus confused with the function of a root. What could you tell me about a root? What kind of traffic is flowing through a root? A root is 100% motor or 100% sensory, depending on which one it is. So where I have the cursor right now, is that a ramus or is that a root? Ramus or a root? That's a root because it's connecting to the spinal cord. Now, is that mixed? No, can't be mixed. It's got to be either afferent or efferent. And what is it? It is efferent or motor because it's the ventral root. All right, and then, of course, the dorsal root, ventral root come together. This is mixed right here. And then those nerves continue on either the posterior ramus or the anterior ramus. So what's the function of a ramus then? Is it sensory or motor or is it mixed? It's mixed because it gets nerve fibers from the spinal nerve right here, which is mixed. Okay. Another good diagram, I think, is this next one right here that shows this. All right, so here's a vertebral body, here's a spinous process, transverse processes. Here is a root, this is the dorsal root, 100% sensory. Here is the ventral root, 100% motor. Here's the spinal nerve is mixed and then it bifurcates to the what? The posterior ramus, because that's to your back. You only have a couple muscles back there. And then here is the anterior ramus that is going to go all the way around, innervates, for instance, the intercostal muscles, right? And then everything else anterior. So that would be the anterior ramus right here. All right, and for the rami, you could call them dorsal or ventral or anterior posterior. The roots we usually call dorsal and ventral. Okay, now you might have noticed some other things in this diagram right here. Let me go back one. Aha. All right, so what do we call all of this nervous tissue right here? What is that? Okay, but what part of the central nervous system is that? Yeah, it's central nervous system. And what part of the central nervous system? What I'm asking you is so simple, you just can't imagine. That's just what? The spinal cord, right? That's just the spinal cord. And, of course, you have tracts that are ascending. You have sensory tracts that are ascending. You got motor tracts that are descending in the spinal cord. But look what we have outside the spinal cord. You have ganglia. See these bulges right here that contain nerve cell bodies and dendrites. And then you have white matter that contain tracts. And these are running up and down on either side of the spinal cord. These act like little auxiliary spinal cords, and these are for part of the autonomic nervous system, in particular sympathetic neurons. And they run on either side of the spinal cord, so these are like auxiliary spinal cords. These are what we call the sympathetic chain ganglia for sympathetic activity. And you can see that there are nerves that bring information from the spinal nerve into the sympathetic chain, and these right here are called the rami communicantes. So now I think you know all the pieces of nerves that have something to do with these spinal nerves. You see the rootlets, you see the two roots, the dorsal root ganglia forming the spinal nerve, and then what is this right here? This is the, that's the posterior ramus, here's the anterior ramus. There is the sympathetic chain ganglia for purely sympathetic activity, and then the two ways in or out of the sympathetic chain, which are what we call the rami communicantes. Yeah, so one is going to be called the white ramus and the other the gray ramus. We'll take a look at that one when we get to the autonomic nervous system. Okay, so let's take a look at this question right here. What branch of a spinal nerve carries afferent and efferent information to the erector spinae muscles? So let's figure out, where are the erector spinae muscles at? They're in your back, way, way in your back. So what kind of a nerve goes to your back? Is it? It's going to be a ramus of some kind. What kind of ramus? Yeah, the dorsal ramus is going to go to the back right there. So what branch of the spinal nerve, okay, that carries afferent and efferent, which means what? It's mixed. What about ventral root? Could that be it? No, because it's not mixed. What about dorsal root? Nope, because it's not mixed, right? How about the ventral ramus, or the ventral, yeah, ventral, you know, that should say ramus, not rami. Rami is plural. Well, there could be from different levels, right? Going to the erector, because the erector spinae is a really long muscle. Ventral rami, do ventral rami, are they mixed? Yes, they're mixed, but where do they go? They go to the anterior body compartment, so could that be an answer for this question? No, I don't like it. What about dorsal ramus? Is it dorsal ramus afferent and efferent? Yes, it is. And where is it going? Dorsal is going posterior to the erector spinae, so I like this answer. Right? This would be a good answer. What about the rami communicantes? Where do they go to? Do they go to erector spinae? No, they go to? Yeah, to the sympathetic chain ganglia. So that can't be the answer. Right? So this is a pretty good little question, right, to be able to analyze to understand how the traffic is laid out. Okay. So there are some important nerves for you to know. Okay. So let me go back to this diagram right here. Okay, notice that, so here's a spinal nerve, right? That's not a cranial nerve. But notice in some locations, look what these spinal nerves do. What do they make right there? Right, they make a little bundle of interconnections between different nerves. Kind of looks like a net or maybe a network or something like that. That's got a special name. That's called a plexus. All right, so different nerves from different origins, like this whole cervical region, come together and form a network and share information and share nerve fibers. This is what we call a plexus. So this would be the cervical plexus right here. Okay, and then we've got the brachial plexus right below it. Okay, this is the brachial plexus right here. I don't know why this block is... should be down a little bit lower. Brachial, so cervical in the cervical region, brachial right over here. Then there's a lumbar plexus, right? And then a sacral plexus. Now, what do you think the job of this plexus is right here? Why on earth do we have this network of nerve fibers? You're going to like it when you hear the reason. So it's kind of good to pay attention to this one. Think of it, maybe you're on your way to school some morning, and what do you do on the way to school? You ever listen to the radio? No? I have to listen to the radio, okay, because it helps me get to school. Why would you want to listen to the radio when you're commuting in L.A.? For listening for traffic, that's right, because there might be an accident on the 405 or something, and I can get off the 405 and hop on the 605, right, to come up to school or something. So if there is a problem on a freeway and you know about it, you can take an alternate route to get around that area that is had an accident, right, that's damaged. The same thing, for instance, in these nerve plexes. Nerve plexes just allow electrical signals that are in your central nervous system alternate pathways to get to important effector organs that otherwise would lose innervation if there was damage to just one single nerve that was going to that effector organ. So the beauty of a plexus is that it gives alternate routes to get to an effector organ so you don't lose control over that effector organ. Okay, so some good examples, a really good example of that, for instance, let's look at the cervical plexus right here. Right, so here's C1, here's C2, C3, C4. They don't have names. Spinal nerves don't have names. Don't forget these are all mixed. And this nerve right here, called the phrenic nerve, this innervates a very important skeletal muscle in your body. Does anybody know where the phrenic nerve, where it goes? It goes to the diaphragm. What does the diaphragm allow you to do? To inhale. And breathing is good. Inhaling is really good. As a matter of fact, if you stop breathing, right, you only have seconds worth of consciousness. So that nerve has to be carrying information to the diaphragm so that you can breathe. Now, where does the phrenic nerve originate from? You see it has a branch coming from C5, but is that the only one? It also has a branch from C4, and is that all? It's a branch from C3, as a matter of fact. Yeah, this branch right here from C3. So the origin of the phrenic nerve is C3, 4, and 5. Right? And then there's a little saying that you can use to help remember that. And that is C3, 4, and 5 keeps you alive because it allows you to breathe. Right? So C3, 4, and 5 form this plexus that sends signals into the phrenic nerve that allows you to breathe. All right, so that's one plexus that you have to know a little bit about and what nerve it forms and the function of that nerve. All right, so all of these little branches here have names. And should I ask you to know all these this semester? Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. That's okay. All right, the ones you got to know is what? The phrenic nerve, C3, 4, and 5 makes up the phrenic nerve. Okay, and what does it allow you to do? To breathe, right. Okay, sciatic nerve. Doesn't come from the lumbar plexus, it comes from the sacral plexus. And indeed, L4, L5, S1, and S2. What does the S stand for? Yeah, the sacral nerves, leaving the sacrum. Okay, and L from the lumbar region, and I think we have a pretty good picture of that someplace as well. Maybe here? Okay, maybe one more picture down. Okay. It's going to come out of this one here. Let me see if I have another picture to show you. All right, so here is the sciatic nerve. All right, so it's a big nerve trunk, and it has from L4, L5, all right, S1, S2, S3. Right here that help make the sciatic nerve, which goes down to your leg for both motor and sensory. So if it was just one nerve and that one nerve got damaged, then you would lose control over your leg, that part of the leg. Okay, so that's the beauty of this plexus right here. Okay. The sciatic nerve is mixed. It's both for motor control as well as sensation. All right, so you have sensation with that nerve, and you have motor control. And as a matter of fact, somebody might have perfect control over their leg, but they might lose feeling, or they might have a tingling sensation. So if somebody is losing feeling in a certain part of their leg, all right, or if they have a tingling sensation in that part of the leg, what can you tell me about nerves that are associated with the spinal cord? Where would you expect to find some nerve damage? If it's not motor, but only sensory, you would say, what? Yeah, a spinal nerve is both sensory and motor. It's mixed. So I wouldn't say a spinal nerve. If it's just sensory, where would you automatically think to maybe look to see if there's inflammation or if there's a disc that's bulging out, compressing something? You would look for the, if it's a sensory deficit but not a motor deficit, what only carries afferent information? The dorsal root, yeah, not the ventral root. So that's an indication that just the dorsal root has damage but not the ventral root. All right, but if you have good sensation but no motor control, what root is being damaged? Yeah, the ventral root, but not the spinal nerve, right? Because spinal nerve is mixed. All right, so that's how you would apply some of these things in the everyday world. And then the last thing that I'm going to talk about is a dermatome. So here we're looking at the surface of somebody's body, and you can see these kind of, well, they're like transverse sections up here in the thorax. So this whole part of the body is innervated from nerves from T8, right, thoracic 8. But when you get down into the leg, notice that they kind of look more like candy cane stripes that wrap around the leg right over here. So this is an area, for instance, for sensation that is going to enter, what, L3, at the level of L3. So if you do a test for sensation and somebody's missing sensation just in this one stripe right here, you know at what level of the spinal cord that the damage is at. All right, but if they can't feel anything here, here, and here, you know what? It's L2 through L4. So the dermatome is just a map that shows how surface sensation corresponds to the roots that enter or leave the spinal cord. So you can actually find where that damage might be without doing surgery or imaging or anything else like that. All right, just by doing a little mapping test right here. Okay, so do you have a pretty good idea of what this dermatome is? And here's the posterior dermatomes as well. Okay. Yeah, you pretty much know. Yeah, just by doing that, just by taking a pin and poking it around and seeing when somebody can feel something or not feel something. But of course, you always want to follow up with a nice imaging study to come up with the diagnosis of how advanced is the disease, you know, how extensive is the disease. Because when you know how extensive the disease is, then you can figure out what is the best treatment. Okay? And then if you know the extent of the disease and treatment, then you always have a pretty good idea what the prognosis is going to be as well. And that's always helpful to know. What does prognosis mean? And that is, how well will you recover after we provide a treatment for you? Okay? Sometimes it's hopeless, and sometimes not. Okay? Sometimes there's full recovery. All right, so the sooner you get the medical treatment usually means what? The better the prognosis will be. Yeah, there's a question up there. A dermatome is a map on the surface of the body that corresponds to a particular spinal nerve. And you can see it's not always regular like we see in the thoracic region. Sometimes it runs down your arm or runs down your back, and sometimes it even curls around a little bit. All depends on what part of your body it is. Right, so that's called a dermatome. And so that's used to isolate damage to a particular spinal nerve. Okay, so I got the sign-in sheet. Anybody else want a sign-in sheet? Everybody sign the sign-in sheet? All right, so maybe you should spend a little time on medicalmnemonics.com. or make up your own mnemonic for cranial nerves. You got to know all 12 of those, which ones are sensory, motor, or mixed. And maybe draw out a spinal cord and draw out the rootlets and the roots and the rami and the spinal nerve. Okay? Okay, that's it. I'm going to turn the recorders off.
You mentioned that we had to know everything as far as people.